cool but addictive music for the UK and the world. Coast 1079.
I'm David Gilmour. Stay tuned for my Rattle That Lock album special coming up next.
Certainly is, and it is a pleasure to actually talk to the main man. He's been around for many, many years, as you all well know, from his Pink Floyd days, starting off in way back 1966. 10 endless albums, and of course, the brand new one is the one we featured as our album of the week. David, welcome to the program. Can I just ask you straight off to you, you know, let's get straight into the albums. Is Rattle That Lock the most musically adventurous of your whole career?
I can't really tell if it's the most adventurous. It's for other people to say. It's a little bit more lively, you could say, than the last one, certainly. And that could be to do with the environment and in your life at the time, and currently living in Brighton, where there's a lot of action going on, a lot of people, a lot of life, as opposed to I was very rural last time for on an island. And all these things can influence the way the music is going, but there's no conscious move in that direction. I didn't consciously try to put up-tempo sort of, what should I call them, not remotely dance tracks, but they're a little bit more up than has been my wont for a little while.
one thing that always fascinates me, did you enjoy making the album? You know, especially as it took so long. It's one of those things that always fascinates me.
There's a moment when you decide that you are making an album. And before that, there are years of sort of doing little pieces of music and putting things together and sitting and fiddling about and perfecting things. And then at some point you say, right, now I am going to have not exactly a deadline necessarily, but you're going to have a target point where you're going to start trying building up momentum and making an album. And that moment was a couple of years ago, I suppose, on this one. But quite a few of the tracks were reasonably well developed before then. It's been 9 years since the last album, so there has been a little bit of meandering. But, you know, there's a busy life going on. Polly's writing books. There's children at school to deal with. I mean, I'm not in the full flow of youthful ambition, which takes over every aspect of life and selfishly charges everything else out of the way. So it's a bit different these days.
I tell you what, a lot of people are amazed at the laid-back voice you've got there as well. How does the legacy of, this is a good one, how does the legacy of Pink Floyd's influence your solo work and also this recording?
It's not a conscious thing, the Pink Floyd legacy. It's part of me. It's, you know, I am part of that sound, and that sound is the sound that I like. So obviously there's a lot of influence, but there's no over respect of any idea that it ought to be like or be different from Pink Floyd. Just whatever comes, whatever arrives and sounds great is what I work on.
What I do think though is, are you aware of the Pink Floyd audience comparing their work to yours?
That's not judging. No, I'm not really aware of them listening and making comparisons. I'm not sitting and making comparisons.
you had to interrupt work on Rattle That Lock for the Pink Floyd album Endless River. Was that pretty strange, or how did you sort of get to feel with that?
Well, the initial thing of starting of putting this album. It wasn't that yet called Rattle That Lock, but putting it on the shelf and getting on with the Endless River, there was an initial moment of irritation that I'd got to stop what I was doing, which I was very focused on and very much enjoying. But, you know, within a few days, you find yourself fully concentrating, realizing what you've got to do and what's got to happen, and getting completely stuck into a different frame of mind. It's, you know, these changes of focus happen to you sometimes in life, and you just have to get on with it.
I mean, some of these questions, David, you know, they're going to be quite nosy, like this one is, where was Rattle That Lock actually recorded?
Mostly at a newish studio in Brighton that I have. Some of the recording goes back a while and was recorded in another sort of small studio room, like home studio thing I have at the farm. And again, some of it was done at the Astoria houseboat. But that's more of a mixing facility, really, these days. We also recorded an orchestra at Air Studios, Air Lyndhurst, up in Hampstead. But most of it was done in Brighton.
Do you have different recording spaces for different types of songs and also the different moods that you're in?
What I have in Brighton is designed to be a one-man operation place, which is possibly in some ways not good for me. I've become a little bit too hermit-like. But it works without a traditional desk and is all cleverly designed so one person can just flick on the computer and work really, really easily, and I can do it all myself without an extra engineer. like I say, there are dangers in that as well.
Absolutely. There's a typical theme running through this album, Rattle Out Lock. What is it?
There is a loose theme running through the record, and that is to carpe diem, seize the day, I suppose you could say. It's the narrative of a day and the things that you could be doing or that you could be thinking about during the day. It's a loose theme, but it really helps you to focus on what you're trying to achieve and give it something to cling to in a narrative way. It's hard to say whether it's actually me, because a lot of the songs, the lyrics have been written by Polly, and we are not one person. We are two people, and she has been more free on this record to write songs that come from herself more than before, when she thought she ought to try and work out what I was thinking and try to become me in the way she wrote lyrics. So, but we do agree on 99%, 99, 95%. A large percentage of what we do and what we believe we agree on, so it's not so difficult.
It's good that you've actually sorted out that, you know, there are two people, not just one, because a lot of people did think that, you know, you had a secret inner you. Five of the songs, the lyrics have been written by Polly Sanson. Now, how does that process work?
With me, traditionally, it's always been that the music comes first. So usually I have played Polly some of the music that I'm working on, and she comes in the studio and listens to it, and she'll say she likes one, and I put just one on her phone, on her iPhone, so that she can walk along with headphones on and listen to it and try and let whatever is in that song get out, I suppose you could say.
Okay. Polly hasn't spoken too much about her work with you. Is that just down to you, or is that intentional?
No, she's very happy to talk about it, and she has done in some circumstances, and undoubtedly will do so again. I like it when she talks about it. She's better at talking about what these things are about than I am. She's much more articulate than I am.
The whole interview is here about the Rattle and Lock, Rattle and Lock the album, David. Can you tell me about the title track?
The lyrical inspiration for the track Rattle That Lock is from Polly. She's been very, very keen on John Milton's Paradise Lost, and in fact her keenness on that has spilt over into her book, The Kindness, that she put out recently, and it's spilt over into this song as well. And it's a song against apathy and about fighting out against what you think is wrong in this increasingly police or government state that we're living in, which is where liberties, civil liberties and personal liberties, are being surreptitiously taken away from us, we think. And it's about how much better you would feel about yourself if you stand up against these things, whether or not you have a a success in achieving what you're going for.
Well, I'm glad you put that in such a context, David, because that's the lyrical inspiration. Now, I've got a musical inspiration coming up in a moment about Rattle That Lock. But before that, do the pair of you have an anti-establishment streak?
An anti-injustice streak, I think you'd have to say it was.
Okay, so we've had the lyrical inspiration. Now, tell me about the title track, the musical inspiration.
Musically, the inspiration came from the four-note musical announcement precursor that they play on French stations. In France, on the SNCF stations, they have a jingle, ba-ba-ba-ba, it goes, which always seemed to me to have both melody and rhythm and a bit of syncopation to it. And that inspired me to record it while I was on one of these stations with my iPhone, and take it home and write a little piece of music with that as its basis. And then I had some guys in the studio, a drummer and a bass player, Yaron Starvey and Stevie de Stanislaw, the drummer. Mm-hmm. And we put down that track. We jammed on with it for over 10 minutes, I think. It was such fun to play. That's where the inspiration for it comes from.
Okay. You wrote the music and also the words to Faces of Stone. Now, what's all that about?
The track Faces of Stone is one that I mostly wrote the words for. Polly is ubiquitous in my life. She actually wrote some lines in there. She's always, helping me get over little moments of blockage. It's a song that really is describing a moment where there was the end of life and the beginning of life in a short period of time together. It's towards the end of my mother's life, where she was suffering with dementia, and there was a crossover period of about 9 months where she was alive at the same time as my youngest daughter, Romany, who was born in 2002. And this is just a little musing on that moment. There's a little phrase, that opens the song Faces of Stone, that just popped out of me without any prompting, describing a moment where we had walked in a park in London back then. Well, she was suffering sort of slight delusions about seeing pictures hanging in trees. And thereafter, it gets harder to move it on from there. But the initial phrase that started it all, it was one of those ones that just popped out.
Yeah, I can imagine. Is it important for you, David, to document your life into songs like that?
It's inevitable. I don't know about how important it is. It's an inevitability. You're going to find that there are things in your life that you're thinking about and that suggest themselves as song ideas that you feel that you want to write about.
Yeah, and of course all the moods as well. Some beautiful orchestrations, lovely vocal work on the album. Tell me about the Liberty Choir and why they're on the title track.
The Liberty Choir are a choir that they're a charity that Polly and I support. They have choirs in prisons, and they have choirs outside prisons called the Liberty Choir, and the prisoners can come and join in with the choir. And this means bringing in people from the outside, 20 or 30 people. Very, very difficult to get the necessary permissions to bring 20 or 30 people into a prison, into a hall in a prison, and then get prisoners to come in and join in and sing with them. And it's inspiring for these guys to come and sing along with a choir, and the woman who runs it, MJ Paranzino, mm-hmm. is a powerhouse.
Wow.
She's a musician and is rather brilliant. And then when these guys get released, because the guys on this program are the people who are in the last sort of period of their imprisonment, they are on their way to being released. And the moment they come out, there is a place they can go to once a week outside of prison, not too far away, where they can go and they can join in again and sing again with people that they have sung in the prison with. And it gives them a sense of community and of worth and of the sheer enjoyment of singing with other people when they get out. It's a very, very valuable stepping stone for people who are leaving prison. It was great. We recorded them in church in Clapham. Obviously, a number of the people who are in this choir regularly, who aren't people who've been in prison, they're in the South London Community Choir. And they all get in there and sing together. They sang together for us in this church. And we used them singing on Rattle That Lock.
That's brilliant. A fabulous track. Tell me about A Boat Lies Waiting, because you sing along there with David Crosby and Graham Nash on this song.
Well, they're old friends of mine. I mean, I've known Graham since he was in the Hollies, and they always recorded at Abbey Road Studios back in the late 60s, early 70s, before he shot off to America. And through knowing him, I've met David, and we've been friends going for quite a good old while now. And they both sang on my On an Island album back in 2006, and they just have a great blend of voices. They came on and played on several dates with me on my tour as well.
Wow.
So it was a natural next step to get them to come and sing on the track A Boat Lies Waiting, which was always designed to have a three-part harmony section going on throughout it. They're life forces. And just have this great vocal blend.
Yeah, they're superb. Pal of mine from Ainsdale, Ron from the computer shop there, he's an astounding fan of Floyd. And he sort of put a question here, said, how hard was it to record this album without Rick Rice?
Without Rick, he's constantly sort of looking over your shoulder. And you're constantly thinking, what do we need to put on this track? In the way of a nice Hammond organ or a nice piano, and realizing that you haven't got the person that you'd like to have playing that piano or that Hammond organ or whatever there, and having to think of other people or just do it yourself. You know, I did a lot of it myself this time. The process for doing that is made much easier by the modern sort of studio technology, cheating it. And doing it all yourself, but it's a great sadness, and thinking of what he could have helped with on this is constantly sitting there.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to being the nosy one now, David. What inspired you to write "Dancing Right in Front of Me"?
"Dancing Right in Front of Me" is a song about one's hopes and aspirations for one's children. I think you'd say. I think I'd say. It's just wishing them to leap forward and grasp life and move it on and have passion for what they do in their lives. It's hard to describe, really, but, observing them from childhood growing into adults, that's the sort of theme of the song. Sort of releasing them from my care and control into the world and saying, go forth and multiply. Well, I haven't done much of that yet. But go forth and lead your life and have joy and have passion.
Okay, getting down to personal choices now, David. This is mine. I just love this track. So The Girl in the Yellow Dress. It's a very different song, both lyrically and music, to anything that you've done.
The Girl in the Yellow Dress is... sort of a jazz, I suppose you'd call it a jazzy sort of track, yeah. Which I wrote some time ago. And in fact, I recorded the backing track for with a jazz trio over 10 years ago. These songs sometimes take a while to release to you what they're finally going to be like. Mm-hmm. And you sort of sit and listen to them and think, well, that's 70% there. But trying to find the last bit that's going to complete it is sometimes very, very difficult, and it was that way with this song. And it came to its fruition on this album with Polly writing those fantastic sort of narrative lyrics. I think she'd felt slightly she felt slightly constrained to writing about things that she thought I would be into, and I think she thought that a narrative song like that wasn't what I was into. But it turns out it is, and it's we have a picture on the wall, which is of a little jazz band playing and a girl dancing wearing a yellow dress, and Polly took her inspiration from that. And as I say, these things take a while to come together, and suddenly it all seems to have come together and fits, and you think, yeah,
I think it's a fabulous track. There are three instrumentals. Yeah, three. Is this a challenge to create new sounds and also new melodies?
It's not really a matter of trying to make songs different or instrumental tracks different. You just, if one comes along that presents itself to you, this was the two of the instrumentals on the album, 5 AM and then are basically the same piece of music, which I had sort of knocking around. I hadn't really even considered it, just not that it wasn't lovely, but it seemed just too simple to be on there like that. But first of all, Phil and Polly both said, "That's too lovely not to have on." So we worked away on it and turned it into the thing that introduces you to the album and closes the album as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of bookends the album. It's a very, very simple instrumental piece with me playing guitar over it. It slightly fooled me for a while into thinking that it was too simple and too easy to be good. But I was brought round to it.
You mentioned you played a little piano on the album as well, but did you play other instruments also on this album?
I play quite a bit of the bass. I play the guitars. I play some keyboards. Mm. I'm not a very good keyboard player, but as I think I said earlier, with modern technology, you can play a little bit of keyboards, and if you get a little bit wrong, you can just correct, you know, play the little bit that you got wrong right and just copy and paste it into a thing. It's a wonderful thing, the newish studio technology that we get to use these days. It's not really important to try to tackle new instruments, but there are just moments where you want something, and I'm impatient, and I want it now. And so I have a go at doing it myself, often, too often. I should take my time and get someone expert in a bit more than I do. But next time, you know. The whole system of recording, the whole plan you use is different every time you do it. And this has worked out one way. The next one will be done a different way, I imagine.
I would imagine so. You've had two number one albums, David, with Phil Manzanera. What's the secret of the successful partnership that you've joined?
Phil is a very good overall view person. He sits there and he has enormous enthusiasm, enormous knowledge, and is always there encouraging and suggesting and pushing things forward. And I need a bit of a push forward sometimes. So, and we've been friends for a long time. It works very well. I mean, I've worked with other producers in the past who are much more bullies than Phil ever is. And sometimes that's effective. Often I find it isn't, but the bullying technique.
Back to me being nosy, David. I mean, people ask me these questions, so because you're talking to the man, so just ask him. We're talking about recording now. What are the guitars that you actually use on the album?
You might think that choosing a guitar for a song is something you spend a lot of time over, but it's just sort of, you sort of look at two or three guitars and you sort of, your hand moves towards one and you just grab it and think that one will do. And you use that. I've used the Gibson Les Paul Gold Top on the intro on 5 AM. And I used a black Gretsch Duojet on And Then, the last track. And my trusty black Stratocaster on a number of other tracks. Acoustic guitars. I still use the Martin D35 that I used on Wish You Were Here back in 75.
Wow.
On most of the time that I'm playing acoustic. Well, that's a choice between two different Martins, one that strums slightly better and one that picks slightly better.
Yeah, well, that certainly solves all the musos that I know. Do certain guitars, David, lead you to a certain type of solo and type of playing?
Yes, I mean, the Gibson is going to lean you a bit more towards the blues, I think, than the Fender. But it's not as clearly defined as all that. You just pick one up and go. They don't put an awful lot of thought into it, I have to say. There's a lot of fuss about how people get their guitar sounds, but 90% of people's guitar sound is in their fingers, It's in the way they play it, and sometimes sort of an anomaly of timing between your left and right hand or something just gives you a certain sound, or the way you use your fingers to pluck the strings. All the rest of it is, it's not hard to get. Anyone could go, I could go into any music store around the country and pick up a perfectly good guitar, amplifier and a couple of pedals and sound exactly like me. It's not, I mean, I think far too much fuss is made over the gear. I mean, you obviously want a nice, powerful, good amplifier nice guitar. But after that, I think it's mostly in the fingers.
Okay, we're almost drawing to an end, David, and thank you very much for the time this afternoon. Back to the album. Does Rattle That Lock reveal a different side to you, do you think?
I think on Rattle That Lock, I have allowed myself to put together, because they arrived, many different tracks, which are very, very different in style. And there are moments when you think, can I really, between a sort of a hardish rock track and a rather beautiful slow instrumental, put something that is so obviously influenced by jazz? And you listen to it and think, well, it's a bit odd, but actually it is all tied together by, it just does sound like me. My voice is my voice. It doesn't sound quite like anyone else's. My guitar playing doesn't sound quite like anyone else's. So that is the force that ties all the diverse elements together, and on this album there are more diverse types of sound, I suppose, than you would be expecting to hear from an album from me.
Okay, who's in the touring band? Who are the band members?
Phil Manzanera is coming out with us. Guy Pratt again, John Karen, Stevie De Stanislau, mostly the people who were on the last tour, obviously not Rick. We're doing the dates here this year, and then we'll be doing some dates in the States next year, next Easter.
I'm glad to see you're not sort of shirking around then and, you know, going into semi-retirement. David, my final question to you is this. Do you still have a sense of excitement about playing live?
Excitement, slight nerves, a bit of dread. Will it be as much fun as last time? All those things come into your mind when you're about to head off out on a tour. Am I too old for this sort of business? It's going to be a lot of fun. I mean, there's some... Yeah, it's going to be easier in some ways to do because it's so up. I'm really looking forward to playing the new album on these dates. We haven't decided quite how or in what order, or whether to do it all as one, the whole album, or whether to do half the album in the first half, the other half in the second half. We're looking at all these things, but I think it's going to be really good, and some of the other guys have rung me to say they think it's going to be really exciting. They're really looking forward to it, so we will see.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to it, and I know an awful lot of your fans, they've stuck with you from about 1966, David. It's been a pleasure talking to you this afternoon here on Coast. Would you just like to sign off? Because I'm going to, once you've said your little piece now, I'm going to go into the title track, Rattle That Lock, but it's been an absolute honour and also a pleasure. Thank you, David.
This is David Gilmour, and you've been listening to my Rattle That Lock album special. Thanks for tuning in.
Rattle that lock, lose those chains. Rattle that lock.
Coast 1079. Loving the music.